Expo Bomb, and we're here to make you think about death and get sad and stuff.
I'm hearing voices, animal voices, the tremor of cold, the feminine of this soon, reaching my threshold, staring at the truth till I'm blind.
Good morning, kids and Keebler bits. Welcome to another amazing edition of After Rot, where we talk about comics, zombies, and whatever the hell else I feel like talking about. Tonight, we have a special guest, Tom Hutchinson from Big Dog Inc. Hello, Tom. How's it going?
Going well.
And by the way, just as an FYI, you may swear on this show if you like to. I just let it out in the front, in the beginning. So, Tom... As a bit of an introduction for you, I ended up finding a... finding was the right term. A blurb that a convention that you're going to be at posted up for you. And I'm going to read it just as an introduction for the fine folks in the areas listening. Tom Hutchinson is the co-founder of Big Dog Inc., as well as the writer and creator of Critter, Penny for Your Soul, Ursa Minor, and The Legend of Oz, The Wicked West. He also serves as the art director for the company's many titles. Tom has taken part in virtually every portion of the industry at one time or another, starting as a reader and collector, then managing a local comic book shop before moving on and owning his own store. Tom has now been writing and creating comics through Big Dog Inc. for the past 7 years, and BDI is now an integrated imprint of Aspen Comics as of 2015. Is that still the case?
It is not the case anymore. We actually just broke off from Aspen last October. We were with them for 3 years, and with their basically, we'll do the long story short. This is Aspen's 15th anniversary this year. So when we were looking at what we were going to be able to do with them from a Big Dog Inc. standpoint, while they were trying to do their big 15th anniversary thing, there just wasn't going to be room on the production plate for much Big Dog stuff. So, you know, Frank Mastromaro and I just talked about it and said, well, hey, you know what? It's a business thing, and you guys got to do what's best for Aspen, and I got to do what's best for BDI. And we just kind of called it quits last September, October, and you know, now we're both back on our own.
Cool. I was actually a little surprised because I didn't know you guys were imprint to Aspen for that time period. I thought it was interesting. It's like, wait, Aspen Comics, I know them. That's Michael Turner's place.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and that was kind of part of the weird part is we could never, for whatever reason, and I still to this day cannot understand it, because the way social media works and the way that I was posting stuff and they were posting stuff, we couldn't really get people to understand what had happened. A lot of people thought that they had bought us. There was all kinds of weird, just crazy rumors, but all you really had to do is jump on social media and see that we became an imprint. They became our publisher, and we were still doing the same books, and I was still doing all the writing. But it was just a really weird thing that we just could never quite get the fan base to understand what happened. And so when we then announced that we had split from Aspen, we kind of got the same response, like, huh, what? I don't understand. So, you know, it was kind of a weird thing. It was a great 3 years. I love every minute of the time that I spent with them, and Vince and Frank and Peter Steigerwald, and, you know, everybody that I met through them were fantastic. But, you know, business is business, and sometimes things don't work the way that you hope they do. And, you know, we're just where we are now, and that's it.
And that's the way business works.
That's it, yep.
I know a lot of people don't necessarily understand how business works. But that's just the way business works, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely.
So
you gotta, and really, you got to be able to just roll with whatever, you know, punches are thrown your way. Otherwise, you're never going to make it in anything you're doing.
Well, yeah. Then you just roll over, and it's like, okay, scratch.
Yep.
Cool. I've got this whole script thing, which I normally don't do a lot of for the show. Like planning things, questions, concepts. So I want to spend a little bit about who is Tom.
Oh, we're going to get deep?
No, not too deep, because that gets creepy, and I don't like to do that unless... No, I'm not even going to do that.
So, if you got a specific question, I'm happy to answer, but otherwise, Tom is a guy who's basically just been holding on to the sort of the pop culture world his whole life. You know, growing up with cartoons and TV in the 70s and 80s and, you know, always kind of trying to be part of it somehow, which is kind of how I ended up running my own comic shop after managing one for like 5 years. So, you know, I've always just kind of felt like this is where I was supposed to be, but I didn't necessarily know where I fit into that sort of pop culture world. And so it just, you know, the writing thing just kind of came about, not really by accident, but, you know, when I started writing, I had a 9-to-5 regular job, and I was working with, you know, the NFL and NASCAR and Major League Baseball and doing all kinds of stuff, selling trading cards, sports cards on those guys' websites. And the comic book stuff was on the side. But when we had our big sort of recession so many years ago, you know, I got laid off, and that's when I kind of, you know, felt like, well, this is the moment that I need to see if I can really do this, if this is gonna, if I'm good at it, you know, if it's gonna amount to anything. And so before I went and found some other job, I just kind of dove right into this, and that's been now 8 years.
So do you still own a comic book shop, or is that a past tense thing?
Oh no, that's very past tense. That closed up basically right after 9/11. The town that I was in California after 9/11 all but shuttered itself completely. So there really wasn't any demand for the comic book world anymore. So we closed it up in 2002, and then that's when I moved on and got the job doing the NFL and the sports stuff.
Okay. Well, I was curious, because when I saw that you were a comic book shop, I'm also a comic book shop owner as well, and I was like, hey, what are the cool things? What? I was like, oh, okay. So, don't mind me. I'm googly.
Yeah, I was 97 to 2001, basically, was my run.
Cool. Did you end up coming ahead, or did you end up... No, nah, actually, don't worry about that. So... When in your comic book shop, was it a Marvel DC thing, or was it an indie thing, or was it a mix of everything?
I mean, it was like any other comic shop, you know, for the most part. Marvel and DC were the dominants, but that was the days of newer publishers, like CrossGen was out at the time, and so we sold them relatively well. So it was a fair mix. We also did a lot of Magic the Gathering tournaments and stuff. We sold a lot of toys, like Star Wars. You know, the prequels had come out, so all the Star Wars toy thing had regenerated itself, and so we were a pretty fair mix of just about everything.
Cool, very cool.
And in fact, you can actually see my shop. It still exists. It will exist forever because it is featured in the movie Comic Book Villains. If you guys have ever seen that,
I think I have.
Yeah, it's the N&J's Comics and Fun, basically the bad guy comic book store. That is my comic book store. So they filmed that there over the course of 3 or 4 days. That was such an incredible period of time. Danny Masterson, Natasha Lyonne, they filmed their night and day. It was incredible. Donald Logue, he's on Gotham right now. He was amazing. So yeah, I had a really great... that was actually right when we opened the stores. They came and scouted us, and they decided they wanted to film the thing there. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. So I've got a nice little memory of the store that'll exist forever.
Very cool. Sorry, I just blanked on something there. It's like, oh my god, what the hell? So going from being a comic shop owner to the job thing, and then going to publishing and whatever, was it a big jump to become a publisher, or did you start as a comic book maker and then publisher?
Well, I mean, I was basically a comic book maker. I mean, I obviously at that time, like I said, I mean, I didn't have anything else happening, so I was trying to do something with it. But you know, I only had one book. I had a company name, and we created a company name, Big Dog Inc., to kind of, you know, house whatever we were going to do. But essentially, you know, for the first year, I only had two titles, Penny for Your Soul and then Critter. So, you know, when we were out at the shows and trying to show off what we were doing, it's not what you see now with, you know, eight different titles and all the banners and all the tables. It's, you know, that was definitely, you know, you got to grow into that. That's not, you know, most people don't normally start that way, and we didn't at all. So It was just definitely a struggle, but you know, we did get enough cool positive reviews. And I mean, Penny for Your Soul, number one, sold out. It's opening printing. And so that was pretty exciting in and of itself. But it definitely took time to, you know, to build from one book to, you know, where we are now.
Well, I can tell you with Penny for Your Soul, I actually had one of my customers specifically ask me to bring it in.
Oh, great.
And at that time, I was like, cool, love this artwork, love the stories. Wait, it's a hotel, and you sell your soul to get chips. Huh. Okay. That was actually a cool idea. I like that.
Yeah, people have really latched onto it. It's always been a very popular book for us, and that's great because I love... I mean, I'm fully aware as a comic book maker, producer, publisher, whatever I am, that you know, art is easily 75% of what you're selling, and I'm a writer and I can accept that. But it is fun when people do actually read the books and come back to you and talk to you about it at shows and you know, online and whatever. There's a couple of I don't know what the, I don't know if they're preachers, pastors, whatever they are. They would come to me in the early days of Penny for Your Soul, and I thought I was going to get read the Riot Act, but they loved the book. They could see that I had done research on the Bible and things that were outside the Bible, like the Book of Enoch and whatever, and they were aware of it all, and they were aware that I was aware of it, so they were fully behind the fictional concepts that I had, but because it was based in what they understood, it was really fun for them, and so that I was not prepared for that at all. But that was one. That's a great, great moment for me is talking to those guys.
And like I noticed this early on with that series as well, that you had the regular cover and the variant cover at the same time released in equal mix.
Sure. Yes. Yeah. We did A and B covers. Yeah. We actually didn't do A and B covers until really the second series. We had variant covers for shows, you know, convention exclusives and stuff. But we were kind of slowly growing into that whole AB cover and so on, but we kind of embraced it as of issue 2 or volume 2 rather, and with all of our other books, Critter had two covers and so on. So once we kind of got into that mix, you know, we just dove in because I'm an art fan, and part of what I've done in my history was I used to be an art dealer, sort of. You know, I love and collect original art, so I would buy pieces and then occasionally sell them and, you know, get new pieces in. So I'm a big art fan, and I'm always looking for new artists and trying to kind of, you know, push the envelope of concept. And so, you know, we try and do really fun stuff for our variant covers. So they're not just sort of, oh, here's another character that's just sort of standing there. We want to kind of do something fun with whatever it is that's going on, be it, you know, the concept or you know, something color-wise that's different. We just like to make it cool. Because if people are going to want to buy our covers just for the cover, then we want to make sure they're going home with something awesome.
So are you gearing that for the collector or the enthusiast? Because one of the things is I'm one of those crazy people that when I buy comics, I get all the covers.
Sure.
Well, but I have specific customers that only just want one that fixates on the thing they want.
Well, one thing that people don't really seem to understand about this industry is that there is no one audience. There are the readers. There are the collectors, there are, like you said, the enthusiasts, there are people who buy specific artists only. They only collect a certain guy or writer or whatever. So, you know, as advice for anyone who's trying to do their own comics is don't ignore those markets. I mean, why would you ever ignore any of those markets? If you can take advantage of them and be a part of each segment of the industry, from retail in stores to retail at conventions, to commission exclusives, to specific artists, to pinup art, you know, whatever. Be a part of it and enjoy it and have a good time with it. It's all revenue. It's all sources of income. And you know, honestly, to hell with anyone who gives you a hard time about making pinup art on your covers. Screw them. Tell them to go, you know, talk to Marvel and DC and you know, if that's more up their alley, then take a hike. You know, you don't got time for that. There's a reason things sell. It's not brain surgery, and there's a market for it. So what's the problem?
I noticed you recently, or I don't know if it's a recent acquisition, but I just happened to notice it recently. On one of your titles, you have Dan Mendoza as a cover artist?
Oh, sure, yeah. We started working with Dan on Penny Well, he technically did a cover for Penny Number 2 in our current Kickstarters, but he did that for Primetime Collectibles, Vince Hernandez's company, so it was sort of a license deal. But he's now done a couple of covers for us for actual Big Dog Inc., and we've got him lined up for our next one in July as well.
Nice, because I love his artwork.
Oh, everybody loves his stuff. He's an absolute rock star right now. Him and Bill McKay are they're DX of of wrestling from back in the day. They are rock stars in comics right now, and I love them both. And I've known Bill forever, and we've always talked about kind of, hey, let's get you to do something here, but it just never worked out until this past year. And once we finally got him on Penny Number 1, it's just been, we opened the floodgates and we've got him locked in for a bunch of stuff now.
So do you find collaborations and stuff like that are a good positive spin on how to get the comic books as a as much as the art, as much as the story?
Well, yeah, I mean, one thing that I've found, and I mean, I've found it for years, but I've seen it again in a large sense with Dan and Bill, is, like I said, there are fans of these guys specifically, and they go and hunt down whatever they do. So by putting Dan and Bill on our books, we've immediately increased our at least our collector, quotient, by hundreds of people, because all of a sudden people are like, what's Penny for Your Soul? That Bill's doing this, Dan's doing this, and now we're doing these Kickstarters, I'm seeing tons of new people just coming in and they're buying these books. And I know they're buying them for Dan and Bill, and that's fine. I have no problem with that whatsoever. But hopefully they'll get them home and they'll at least crack the insides and, see what's going on the inside. And hopefully they'll like the story too. And I think they will. And 9 times out of 10 that happens. And I get them to come back and they say, hey, I bought this thing because of Dan, but it's really cool. How do I get the rest of it? So, it's just that's it. I mean, again, you got to take advantage of everything that you possibly can to attract anyone from anywhere to what you're selling.
So it's like the pushers thing, you get one in there going and it's like, oh wow, tap, yeah, get into the rest of it.
Yeah, oh, that happens all the time. I get people that are constantly asking me, because Penny for Your Soul Volume 1 is out of print, and they're constantly asking me, dude, how do I get it? And I always tell them, go to eBay, go to Amazon, they're there. But the last time I went and looked, all of them, every single copy was like $100 a shot. I was like, oh my God, what has happened here? Because you as a writer, as a publisher, you like it when your stuff increases in value, but at the same time, you want as many people to get it as they can. And so asking somebody to spend $100 on a trade paperback is asking quite a bit.
Yeah.
But the people have just figured it out on their own. They've hunted down single issues here and there, and they're finding their way. And most of them will just buy the digital so they can read it at least, and then they'll go hunting down the copies and fill in their collections as we kind of go along.
Yeah, because true collectors, they're willing to wait until I have it all.
Yes, absolutely, sure.
Oh, I know what that's like. I'm also one of them people. It's always fun. The search is actually more fun than anything else. Like, how do I find it? Oh, going through the backorder bins, going through the bins. It's like, oh, crap, I need this one. Do I need this one? I do think I need this one. I better get this one.
Yeah, I totally agree. The hunt is easily, half the fun of comic book collecting. So I do the dollar boxes at shows and hunt around for things. I used to be a very big collector of Zatanna back in the day. She was like my character that I would
still
collect anything that she was in, anything at all. Didn't matter if she appeared in one panel in the background of some crowd shot, I would buy it if she was in it. And I have 99% of everything pre-New 52 that she's existed in. There's a couple of things I don't have yet, but it was a really fun thing to do because she appeared in so many different books that, it really kind of exposed me to things that I would have never bought to begin with. Blue Demon or Blue Devil, Green Lantern, all kinds of just weird stuff because she's a magician, so she was in a lot of weird Vertigo stuff and whatever. So, it was a really great collection and I still have it. It's one piece of the collection that I have not gotten rid of just because it was so much fun to put together.
Yeah. I like Zatanna. I've always been into the magic and space shit. So any of that stuff that's usually been in the comics has been, yes, okay, I'll get those.
Yeah.
Yep, that one.
I mean, to me, Zatanna, I haven't read any of the New 52 stuff, so what I'm told is that they kind of depowered her for that, for the Justice League Dark. But prior to the New 52, I mean, really, honestly, she's the most powerful character in comics or in DC Universe. I mean, she literally rebuilt Metropolis, you know, by saying her little spells backwards. And because she's a magic user, she could take down Superman. So, you know, she's got it going on. I mean, she even mind wiped Batman. So, you know, she's no joke.
Okay, so in that same vein, there is a crossover series with Swamp Thing, Constantine, and Zatanna in it. And that one was really well done. And that's fairly recent.
If it's fairly recent, I probably haven't seen it. I don't even get to comic book shops often anymore. When I work out in Arizona at Jesse James Comics, I'm around all the comics all the time. But when I leave and I'm on the con circuit and I'm bouncing around and jumping around and doing shows and doing my work, my writing, I haven't been in a comic book store in probably 3 months now.
I am shocked. So something new, I am totally shocked.
Yeah. That's just the life of the comic book guy. I get my comic book fix when I'm at a show. You know, I'm having a convention. I kind of get in. I bounce around. I see what's going on. But as far as like the weekly or even the monthly thing, I would, where I live right now in Michigan, it would be a 45-minute drive to the local comic book store. So in Grand Rapids, so it's not exactly an easy trip.
That's okay. You can get there anytime.
Oh yeah.
With the power of the internet, you can always get this stuff emailed. Or mail.
This is very true. The problem for me though is that I'm way too what's the term? I want it now. If I'm paying for it, I don't want to wait 3 days for it. I need to take it home with me so I can jump on the bed and, you know, read the comic book before I go to bed. So that's kind of my mindset. So I don't buy a lot of stuff online. I'll get to a comic book store or I'll buy it from folks at a show and I'll just come home with a bunch of stuff.
Okay, I'll give you that one. So, speaking of conventions, how many conventions do you do a year as a regular thing?
Oh, it's way low now.
Way low?
But that's sort of, yeah, it's way low because it's self-imposed this year because, you know, we used to do 20 to 30 a year when we were really hustling early on. And then when we were with Aspen, I was doing easily 10 to 15, roughly. But kind of a self-imposed exile right now because now that we're not with Aspen, I had to kind of figure out a way to reboot my entire company. You know, every one of my comics, my entire everything had to be reset so we could get it back out into people's hands. And so last October is when we started our first Kickstarter, which was Penny for Your Soul Volume 4. And that was sort of our plan, was to do one of those quarterly. And then as we did those quarterly campaigns, you know, we'd hit a few shows to kind of help promote them and you know, we were at C2E2 and so on. But because there's so much travel involved in all of that, and I'm basically one person, you know, whereas before we had a team of people that would help us do everything, I'm basically one person. I just couldn't justify all of that travel when I needed to be writing books. And content right now is the most important thing. To get, like, because like I said, people sort of lost track of us for 3 years when we were with Aspen. So I've got to let everybody know, you know, hey, we're still here. Hey, we're still making books. And here they come.
Okay. So that being that, and one of the main reasons why I brought into that segue about the conventions was, as we know, both Dirk Manning.
Yep.
He is a machine for conventions. I mean, he does, well, like, what, 38 of them a year?
Oh, sure.
Crazy stuff. And on top of that, the segue to that is you just had a Kickstarter that finished with Dirk Manning doing some stories for Ursa Minor.
Correct.
Tell me how that happened, because I've known Dirk for years.
Oh, I've known Dirk forever, sort of loosely, originally, through an old website. I think it's still running, but it's called Digital Webbing. He and I kind of both got a little bit of our start in there. But that's where I kind of knew him from, chat room boards and so on. But then we met at a show called DanCon in Chicago, I don't know, 6 years ago or so. And we had met for the first time, and we just kind of hit it off. And he pitched the idea to me of writing a Flying Monkey story for my Legend of Oz series. And I told him, I was like, look, man, everybody wants to fluoride the Flying Monkeys. You know, why? What? You know, even I want to do it. Why am I going to give it to you? And so, you know, we went back and forth. And finally I said, okay, look, you can have four issues. You got to tie it into my story because I don't want just a loose floating monkey story. I got to tie it all in. And so he did, and it sold tremendously well. It was a great story regardless of, you know, what we tried to do. It was just, he made it great, and he made it work with my existing story, which was the key, because that way people that had already been reading it wouldn't just sort of hit a wall and get a monkey story. Everything that I had been doing kind of weaved through his story, which was perfect. And then we just kept talking. You know, we'd see each other at shows a lot, and I think I had just mentioned something about, I was, you know, because we were doing annuals for Critter and so on, and I said, yeah, we got the Ursa Minor annual coming out, and he was like, well, I could write that for you, and I was like, oh, well, you know, maybe we could do that, and so it just worked itself out. You know, it's, that's comics. I mean, if you're open to, you know, collaboration and you know, working together, I mean, it's great things can happen, and this book, particular book, was about to be published right before we went over to Aspen, and that's why it was never published. So, you know, we had it kind of in our back pocket, and I thought, hey, you know, we're doing these Kickstarters, but I have so many different books that just focusing on one title for so long, especially if we're only doing them quarterly, it's going to take forever to get some of these other books back. So I thought, well, hey, maybe I could just drop a quick campaign in, sort of in between Penny for Your Souls. And that's where the idea for the term Quickstarter came from, because instead of the sort of the standard month-long campaign, this was just a 10-day campaign. It was a book that we had almost all done anyway, so it wasn't like we needed extra time to finish it. And it was, you know, it was a very much of an experiment, but it came out really well. I was blown away by the support that we got for it. We got 320 backers in 10 days. Now, just to compare that to our most successful ever Kickstarter, which was the one we had done previously with Penny for Your Soul, it took 21 days to get to 320 backers with Penny for Your Soul. So the fact that we did 320 in 10 days, if we had done an actual full month, I mean, it would have been a blockbuster campaign. But as it was, it did great. It did more than we had wanted it to do. And now we get to put that book out along with Penny and move on to what's next.
So with the Kickstarter, I mean, this becomes a curious question for me a lot, because I have never been able to really grok the whole idea behind using the Kickstarter as the launching point. But I enjoy the fact that it's successful when it's successful. The idea of the questions I have about Kickstarter tend to revolve around, how much of the pre-preparation do you have this already? You've already answered part of that for this one, but on a standard Kickstarter for one of the other titles, how much of the pre-work is already done, the artwork and the panels and the storyline?
Well, the story is basically written. I mean, that's my job. I got to give that to the artist so he can do his job. But like, for example, for this upcoming one that we're doing in July for Penny for Your Soul number 4, I already have two covers finished. I have two more that are already approved and layouts and are almost finished. JB, who is the artist for the book, he and I are already working on pages. So by the time we get to the book, which is roughly 3 weeks from now, a little over 3 weeks, we'll be at least halfway done with the book by the time we even launch the campaign. So that way, by the time the campaign is over, the book should be pretty close to wrapping up within a couple of weeks. And then we can go to print. So that's kind of our system that we're kind of trying to put into place is, you know, we work on this book, and when we're done with it, it goes to print, it gets out to you guys, and it should land in your email or in your mailboxes either a week before or a week into the next campaign, so that it kind of all plays on each other, you know, it layers up so that people are like, oh, I got my books. Oh, yeah, there's another Kickstarter. And then, you know, we keep on going.
So like a continued domino effect.
Correct, yes. It's absolutely a domino effect, yes.
So that's cool. I mean, so you've had how many Kickstarter events gone now since the... mentioned end of October, whatever was the changeover from Aspen to BDI only?
Right, yes. We did one in October, one in January, one in April, and then the Kickstarter we just did. So we've done four since October, and then Penny Four starts in July.
Cool. So are you the only writer then at BDI?
I am, yes. We've had other people work on stuff in the past. Pat Shand, who a lot of people know from Zenoscope, and he's with Avatar now. He's done a lot of stuff. He, along with Keith Thomas, Libby Rich, Eric Esquivel, they did some one-shots issues for Critter for us. We've had some people work on some backup stories and annuals and things. But as far as the primary storylines for all of our books, they're all me. Now, the exception is Scheherazade, because Scheherazade was my idea. It was my concept, but I actually handed it off to our editor, Kerry Castor, to actually do the scripting and sort of develop, help me develop the idea and the word, the world, rather. But, yeah, all the rest of the primary books, these are all my books, my characters, and it's my story. So, you know, get out of my sandbox.
Okay, so, I mean, that leads into another question that I generally like as well, is since Image, or way back in the day, reimagined the idea being that owner-created content is the way to go with a lot of characters and stuff, how do you see the comic book industry overall evolving in that way?
I think it's, well, it's tricky because there's a lot of creator-owned stuff that isn't really necessarily creator-owned. There's a lot of companies who let people still own a piece of their creation, but they're really IP farms, and so they're kind of absorbing the IP to try and develop it into other things. So every publisher is a little bit different as far as how they deal with that stuff. But I know, like, IDW has legitimate creator-owned things and so on. But, you know, Image is really the benchmark for how to get a bunch of creators together, work together, not necessarily on books together, but as far as a company-wide thing, and you know, produce great stuff over a long period of time. But, you know, there's even people who are leaving Marvel and DC to do their own stuff. Ethan Van Sciver just left DC and he's doing Cyber Frog again. I mean, can you imagine that?
Cyber Frog.
But there's a lot of guys that work for Marvel and DC that do their own stuff, and they do it at the same time. So it's not like they're just bailing out and doing something else. But I think every creative person in comics ultimately has their, you know, I want to do this. They have their story that they want to tell. And, you know, comics in general are, you know, such, the genre is so diverse right now. I mean, there's literally anything that you could possibly want. There's a comic about fencing, okay?
Yep, there is.
There's anything that you could potentially want in comics right now. So anybody who says, well, I don't like comics, you're not paying attention. You literally can walk into a comic book store that carries indie stuff and find virtually anything, Westerns, romance, anything. We're in a really golden age of genre, and creators are taking advantage of that.
Exactly. I mean, I see thousands. From what I understand, from according to Diamond's previews, there is approximately 10,000 new titles released every year.
Just
anime.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, absolutely. I had to throw that. But yeah, you're right. There are you can get into any kind of genre. I mean, love stories, horror stories, science fiction. Just like John Carpenter has a complete science fiction only story series going out, and there's thousands of them out there.
Yep. Anything that you like as far as movies and TV, it's all licensed. You've got more stories. Winona Earp has stories. Transformers have stories. I mean, there's literally anything. So anyone who's coming in and saying comics aren't for me, they're just not trying.
Or that they don't like to read.
Oh, that's true, too. That's true, too.
Which there is a segment out there.
The one thing that I will say about comics that is a legitimate sort of, I don't know, quote-unquote complaint that I hear from people, because I work in comic book stores, is they do get frustrated from the standpoint of creative team changes. So maybe they get 4 or 5 issues of a specific artist, and then it changes to somebody else. Now, a lot of comic book people are used to that. I mean, that's just the way that it is. But a lot of people aren't used to that. They are looking for more continuity in their creative teams. And so to go from, for example, Joe Madureira on a book to, you know, I mean, I'm not going to try and put anybody down, but somebody else, right? We all know how great Joe Madd is. To go from those to two extremes, you know, maybe they go from a Joe Madd to something that's more cartoony and animated looking. The reader is going to be like, whoa, what just happened here? I mean, I went from what I knew to something completely different. And a lot of people will drop out when those art changes happen. And that's a legitimate thing. I mean, when you look at, like we just talked about manga stuff, I mean, that art is consistent forever.
Yeah.
People get you know, years of consistent, you know, art style from that. Whereas with comics, if you get an arc, you're doing well. If you get two arcs, you're doing really well. And then usually you get some turnover. So that's the one thing that I think comics really has to focus on is, you know, if you've got an art team, writing team that's working and people are digging it, man, you got to keep those people on that book for as long as you can.
I agree 100%. In the more positive side of it, it's like going from Jack Kirby to Bernie Wrightson. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Both excellent artists, but you're getting a completely different style.
Totally different styles. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And I've seen.
We all know that art's subjective and arbitrary, and so people will find something that they like. But as soon as that changes, if it's not something that they equally like, they'll drop that book.
Yeah. I can say that the one thing that kills me the most about comics is you kill a character. Keep him dead. Don't keep bringing him back.
Well, that's something that we do with our books. I mean, I killed off a character in Critter, and I had people coming to shows going, she's not really dead, right? And I had to kind of look at him and be like, well, yeah, I'm afraid that's what it is. And they were devastated, but they didn't drop the book. They were just kind of like, oh, my God, that you know, it meant more, you know. Obviously, they wanted the character back. They wanted to be excited. Oh, she's back or whatever. But at the same time, if it's real, then that story carries more weight.
Exactly. Look at the impact that Game of Thrones has on people now in pop culture. Oh, my God. He killed right? someone. He killed what? Who? Huh? Who?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So that's a great example.
I love that stuff. It's awesome. People are like, they killed my favorite character. Yes, they did. So... okay, so back to BDI. And by the way, do you mind if I call it BDI?
No, that's fine.
Acronyms are, like, so much fun. Do you absorb in new talent? Do you bring in, like, do you reach out to try and bring in more storyboarding, or is it just you doing it?
Well, I'm always looking for new artists, whether it's for covers or whatever. I don't always have space for them at the time, but I like to know what's out there. And that way, you know, if I'm doing something, I'm like, hey, you know what? I need a cover here. And I was just talking to this guy, and I think he'll fit. I'll shoot him a message and be like, hey, you know, do you want to do a thing? So I'm always looking for artists. I'm always looking at shows. I'm always looking online. You know, I'm in tons of Facebook groups and stuff that post art. So I really get a nice flow of, you know, new people doing stuff. And as soon as something catches my eye, I'm all over it, and it's already happened multiple times this year alone, as I've, you know, tried to snag some new people for covers.
Cool. We'd also spoken, sort of chatted a little bit beforehand about the change in the way that you were doing distribution from away from Diamond, which, as some people may know and some people probably haven't got a clue about, is the default de facto worldwide distributor of comic books for all of the mains, and then a lot of the not-so-mains
yes.
through the world. And you guys had taken it back from that to not deal with distributing that way. So I imagine that most of your distribution or your sales now would be mostly U.S.?
To a degree. I mean, we've always sold well to Canada, Australia, U.K., and we still do it. It's a little easier with Kickstarter because a lot of that shipping stuff gets handled right up front. But you know, we will literally ship anywhere, and we have been. So it's doing it yourself doesn't mean you're limited to what you can do. You're only limited by what you decide you want to do. So if you were to decide, well, we're not going to ship to any countries, then you just don't. But if you decide you're going to find a way to make sure the UK gets what they need, then you line that stuff up and you get it done. Again, that's just if you don't do it, you're just throwing revenue away. So, you know, figure out a way to do it.
So is there any countries where you don't ship to?
I will ship to anywhere as long as they understand that the shipping sometimes gets high. You know, guys in Australia know that, you know, if they're buying a book, it's probably going to cost them $20 to get, you know, some stuff shipped over. But for the most part, they're not concerned. They just want the book, and they understand sort of the rules of the road, and it's not really a problem.
All right. So I was just trying. By the way, new previews came out this week, and I was just trying to remember the name of this one company, and I can't remember who it is, and it's pissing me off because I wanted to share a very specific thing about a company.
Okay.
Because I recently just found out that any of their books are no longer allowed to come into Canada. Where is it? Aspen. Oh, look. Aspen's still here. Ah, Boundless. That's who it was.
Oh, Boundless. Okay.
Yeah. Because
is that because of all the sex stuff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. So that's why I was curious about it, because that's a kind of a thing for Canada, is that there are some very specific rules in the way that that works. And I was wondering if you've had to ever come up across any of those.
Never. Not one time.
Cool.
But okay. But that boundless stuff goes above and beyond. So
some, you know, of it.
Yeah.
that's the funny thing about it. It's like, okay, I understand this title here, which has hardcore sex scenes, and it's like, yeah, okay, I get that. That shouldn't be necessarily coming across normal channel. But this one over here is like, it's just a normal story going on, whatever. That's also restricted now, too.
Yeah, that's just going to be, you know, line wide. They're just not going to worry about what does what. They're just going to say, nope.
Yeah.
That's it.
The wide swash is like, yeah, everything. Okay, fine. No worries. So, excuse me. Sorry, I had to swallow that. Now, other than your own material, what other kind of comics would you be interested in more?
Oh, God.
You've already covered Satana.
Yeah, I don't... It's hard for me because I don't read a lot. When I do, it's usually like I'll grab a trade paperback of something and kind of binge it. That, again, that's just because of the way that I live. I don't have the time for the monthly thing. So for me, it's like I'll hit a store, hit a show, and I'll just kind of look through the trade paperbacks and see what's kind of floating around in there. But I'm pretty wide open. I mean, I don't really look for Marvel and DC stuff. That's really not where I'm going anymore. You know, I'll watch stuff from Image and so on. I've been watching other people's Kickstarters and you know, contributing to those. So I'm not really restricted. Like, I if it's horror, if it's superhero, like to me, Invincible was the greatest superhero book we've had in the last decade. And I'm bummed that it's over. But you know, anything can come from anywhere. And so for me, as just a writer and a comic book sort of connoisseur, I'm open to anything as long as it, you know, looks cool and has some sort of general concept that, you know, sort of makes sense to me, I guess.
Well, that answers the one question that I had written down here, is like individual issues versus trades. It's like, okay, I guess you're going with trades then.
Yeah, again, that's just a necessity for me. I do buy some singles from time to time, especially if it's got a cover that I like or an artist or something. So I'm not completely out of the loop on that. But, you know, for me, it's just easier to have the trades around than to do the single issues.
Okay. So part of the question I was getting into with the evolution of comics also involved. So, I mean, I'm also book writing as well. So I watch how that industry is moving too, and a lot of it is moving more and more digital, more and more, hey, less on the physical, more on the digital. And one of the things that I've been saying for a while is that I think comics are going to do pretty much the same thing, and then the printed copies would just be premium editions for those hardcore collectors. What do you think about those?
Yeah, that's actually been my thought process for years. Physical comics will never go away, but I think that they will probably move into a more premium format. Just for the guys who want to get the signatures and so on. You know, I don't know how fast that's going to happen. I don't know that digital is really as pervasive as a lot of people think it is. But, you know, it's there, and it happens and it sells. I find it weird that Comixology doesn't let you buy things through their app anymore. You have to do it online and then download it into the app. That's very strange to me.
That's probably a rights thing.
It could be, but it again, it makes it less functional to me. Like, I remember I had Comixology app on my iPad for a while, and I would just click on things and get them. I don't want to have to, like, do something else. Like, I don't know, it's extra steps, it feels like to me. So, you know, I don't know that digital has quite figured out what they're doing yet or how to do it, but it is happening. It's there, and it's not going away either. But for me, and you know, it's one more reason, like, for right now, we're basically in that premium format for Big Dog Inc. Everything we do is very limited. So, for example, when we do a Kickstarter with our A cover, where normally we would print, like, you know, maybe 3,000, 4,000 of the A cover alone, now we're printing like 800 of them. And then, you know, that goes along with our variant covers as well. So we're already in that premium sort of format as far as Big Dog Inc. goes.
Do you number them as well?
They're not serial numbered, but they are limited. Like, on the back, it'll say, you know, limited amount of 800 or 200 or 100 or whatever. But we've always done that. We've always done our variants where they let you know, hey, there's 200 of these, 300 of these. But the big change is we now, instead of are selling 3,000 to Diamond, we're selling, you know, 800 just through. Our Kickstarters and our websites and stuff. So we exist in that premium format already. And, you know, I'm not against Diamond at all. They would take us back tomorrow if I gave them a call. But the industry right now is so saturated with publishers.
Oh, yeah.
And all those publishers are pumping out books like there's no tomorrow, that even if I brought Big Dog back now, I don't know that we would see any numbers that would make any real sense, you know. So I would rather just focus on the us directly selling to you, and, you know, let's work together and build something, me and you, and you know, I want to partner with comic book stores, you know, rather than just be part of a giant catalog. So we've got a couple of comic book stores who are the charter members of the Kennel Club, Jesse James Comics in Arizona, Comics and More in Madison Heights, Michigan. Creative Comics down in Indiana. We've got a few more that are lining up to help, you know, become part of this. So, you know, same with shows. You know, we want to partner with shows and make their shows awesome. We don't want to just be some random faceless, hey, oh yeah, here's a publisher that wants to come in. Okay, fine, we'll sell you a booth. Like, I want to do your panels. I want to do your portfolio reviews. I want to talk about Kickstarters. I want to talk about breaking in. I want to partner with people. This is what this industry is missing. Everybody's just sort of floating around loose. Let's focus up a little bit more and make these comic conventions more comic related and make them great. And it's really hard to do when you have so many shows too, because all these shows, if you've got four major shows on the same weekend, well, you've just separated your talent by a quarter across the country. Meaning, you know, if you've got Art Adams in San Francisco, well, he can't be at C2E2 or he can't be at anywhere else. So the shows themselves have to figure out how to upgrade themselves by you know, not competing with each other. Then, and obviously Texas and San Francisco, you're not really competing because the fan bases are going to stay where they are.
Oh no, but they are competing, because this is one that's something that I specifically noticed with Fan Expo, which is the huge convention here in Toronto.
Yeah.
Is that Dragon Con and Fan Expo were coming out on the same weekend,
right?
So they were competing for the guests.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. They're competing for the guests, yes. But what I'm saying is your attendee base is not going to necessarily change, but your what you can actually do with your event changes if you can get 25% more awesome people into your show. Your event becomes better. So yes, you're right. They are competing with the guests, absolutely, and that's the problem.
Yeah, and it's like I said, with Dirk Manning, he's on like 38 conventions in a year or whatever ridiculous number it is. But he's like, every weekend there's a convention that he goes to, pretty much.
Sure, yeah. When you're in the, especially when you're in the Midwest, there's literally a con somewhere within 6 hours of you every weekend. So it's not too tough to do that down here in the Midwest.
Yeah, and that's understandable. So I'm just looking at a little list of a number of the other titles that you guys have put out, and I have to say, one, I've had, and the other, I just like the name of. Rex the Zombie Killer. I had that series. Yep. That was fun.
Yep, that was one of the creator-owned books that we published, along with Nightingale, Ned the Chainsaw Guy, and Pinpoint. Those were all guys that brought their books into Big Dog, and they, just like, you know, we went to Aspen, they brought their stuff to us, and we became their publisher.
Cool. I just like the Ned the Chainsaw Guy comic title.
Sure, yeah.
I may have to find that.
They're out there. They're not easy to find, but they're out there.
Well, the Rex is actually, I think, still available. In, like, I've seen bits and pieces of it, I think, in Diamond.
Well, if I'm not going to remember his name now. If the creator is doing something with it, that's possible. But it's not through Big Dog.
Oh, okay. So because maybe I'm just misremembering the names.
Yeah, when we went to Aspen, you know, we basically had to cut ties with the people that we were working with because it was just a Big Dog deal. It wasn't those guys coming in with us. You know, Wayne Gardner has continued with his Nightingale series and so on. So if Rex is out there, it's under a different publisher.
Oh, okay. And that's the fun thing about comic books, right? Things can change and move around and still be cool.
Oh, yeah. That happens all the time.
Yeah. So, rights and issues and stuff like that about comics. I mean, do you see any of the comics that you guys have put out moving into, like, TV shows or movie type style? Or even animated shows?
The Legend of Oz, The Wicked West, was almost a TV show about 5 years ago. It got up to the top ladder of a company, and we basically ran into two schools of thought that shut us down. One was one guy believed that Westerns didn't sell. It was like, well, have you...
Did he not watch Firefly?
Yeah, have you seen what you produce in Hollywood? There's Westerns constantly. But then the other guy was basically, I don't get it. Like, what exactly don't you get? You have a live storyboard in your hand with this first trade paperback, this first volume. How can you not get it? But, you know, that's Hollywood. That's what it is. And that just means we got to climb a different ladder to find somebody who gets it. So, you know, nothing right now is actively being sold or anything, but... you know, we're open to it should anybody want to get serious. You know, every now and then you'll see me post. I made a little fan art Ursa Minor movie poster using Chloe Grace Moretz as
my name.
So every now and then I post that up there. I throw it on her Facebook pages and stuff. I tell her, look, you know, if you ever want the book, I'm happy to send you a copy. So, you know, we're definitely open to doing it, but we're also not against the idea of just kickstarting something too. You know, we've seen TV and movies and people do stuff through Kickstarter that they've produced their movies and their TV shows and their pilots. So, you know, again, Kickstarter is a wide open channel that you can do anything with as long as you have an existing fan base that's sort of along for the ride already.
Cool. So along with that, I mean, another big question I ask a lot of guests is the social media aspect about trying to, keep in tune with your customer base, your fan base, whichever, and engaging in them.
Sure.
One of the things that I've always found is that a creative, whether it's the writer, an artist, actor, or actress, director, whatever scope, scale, whatever, is it, they engage with the fan base or the consumer base, they get a much better response than the guy who just puts stuff out and says, "Yeah, I got stuff out there."
Oh, sure. Yeah. Social media is a really difficult nut to crack, but it is absolutely imperative that you use it. You know, Facebook, Instagram, whatever, they all have their own ways of doing things, and you know, it's your job to figure out how to use them to let the people who buy your stuff know that, you know, there's more stuff. But at the same time, it's not just solely about posting things like, hey, buy my thing, buy my thing, buy my thing. It's about people getting to know you. You know, they want to connect with the creator. They want to know, hey, this guy who writes Critter, this cat girl superhero, you know, he's this big dude that looks like he probably likes, you know, thrash metal. How is he writing this kind of goofy cat girl comic? But then as you watch people on social media and watch what they post, you start to understand that, for me, you know, I still exist in the comic book world of the 70s and 80s, so my stuff is not sort of as serious and as, you know, sort of real world as a lot of, you know, comics are now, especially superhero stuff. They're getting so bogged down in real world nonsense. So you'll see that I'm a big Godzilla fan, and I love the Transformers, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. I mean, like, if you look at my CD collection, it's got everything from, sure, there's some Metallica in there, but guess what? There's also Britney Spears and John Williams soundtracks and Samantha Fox and, you know, everything from the 80s. It's, you know, so the social media helps people understand who you are and connect with you in different ways beyond just the, hey, I'm buying a comic book from you. So, you know, it's not an easy thing to sort of do, but it is absolutely imperative if you want to, you know, really sort of get people involved in your work.
And every time I come up with a segue to go into something, I can't remember the name of the thing that I was going to segue. Damn it!
Godzilla? It was something Godzilla?
Actually, it was Samantha Fox.
Oh, okay.
and Brittany. And, oh, shit. It's a movie. Damn it! Mega... No, not Mega Shark. Okay. Forget it. If Jack was in the chat room, he would have been able to pop up the name of it. Giant snakes and giant alligators fighting each other, and it has a monkey in it.
Well, there is Lake Placid versus Anaconda, but I don't know that there's a monkey in it.
No, a monkey being one of the monkeys from the band.
Oh.
That was their tagline in the movie. It was that, okay. And yes, there's a monkey in the movie. Wait, what? How does that actually compare to anything? Damn it. No, not sharks. Alligators. Gators. I don't know. I might be able to fit. I probably won't. Oh, well, whatever. But there's... she had the one song, I Think We're Alone Now.
Oh, yeah, that's Tiffany.
Tiffany, that's it.
Yeah, it's Tiffany and Debbie Gibson.
That's the one.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... yeah, I know what you're talking about. That was a god-awful movie.
But it was funny.
What was really funny was the writer was intent on making each of them, for those of you who don't know, Tiffany and Debbie Gibson were basically the Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera of the 80s. The writer was intent on making each of these singer-actresses say the lines from the songs of the other person's songs. It was really irritating, but that was like his goal through the whole thing, was just to, you know, have these weird meta moments, but
it made me laugh my butt off.
Yeah, it was a very strange movie.
It was Mega Python versus Gatoroid.
There you go.
I had to get that out because it was in my head and it had to come back out. That's why I'm so glad computers are easy to use and navigate with. It's like, okay, I can type over here quickly and nobody hears me. It's like blah 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 blah. So one more question.
Sure.
And that is, if you were recommending something to new comic creators, how should they go about breaking into it as if they were?
Well, that's a...
The quick and condensed version.
It's sort of a tough question because there's breaking in as a writer, there's breaking in as an artist, and so on. You know, for me, I don't even think I really broke in anywhere. I just made my own spot.
That's a form of breaking in.
I haven't worked for any other company. I mean, I worked with Aspen, but I didn't really work for them. I didn't write any of their you know, any of their books. It was still just me doing my stuff. So, you know, it really depends on the definition of breaking in. Breaking in to me means you've made it somewhere else. You know, you've gotten into Marvel or DC, and I don't know anything about that because I haven't done it. But as far as just doing it yourself, you know, the keys are, you know, you've got to treat it like it's a job, you know, because that's what comic books are. It's a job. And it's, you know, if you've got a 9-to-5 already, you've got to come home and find that time from you know, you're home at 6 o'clock, you go to bed at midnight. Well, that's 6 hours that you can be working on whatever it is you're going to be working on. You've got to find the time to keep doing it and be consistent with it. And it doesn't end, and this is particularly with Kickstarter people because I see this all the time, it doesn't end once you have your book in your hand. That's just the beginning of your journey. Because the next steps are get to the shows, do your social media like we talked about. You've got to engage people. And there's a lot of people who aren't prepared for all of the extra effort that goes into the back end of creating. Creating is the fun part. Then there's the side where you got to actually sell your stuff.
So, speaking of selling your stuff,
yeah,
how do people find your stuff online? Because we're getting right to the end of the episode, and it's like, oh, I might start wrapping this up right now.
Yeah, sure. Well, if you go to bigdoginc.com, that'll take you right to our web store. It's got everything that we have available is in the web store. So that's the super easy place to find all the stuff to get. Because like I said, we're not in comic book stores anymore. So if you want our stuff, you got to go to bigdoginc.com. You can find us on Facebook. There's a great big fan page for Big Dog Inc. I'm Critter's Daddy on Instagram. I am TJH Big Dog Inc. on Twitter. So I'm out on the social medias and talking to people all over.
Excellent. So, Tom, thank you once again for coming and joining.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Everybody out there in the After Rotten line, have yourselves an After Rotten amazing time. This show will probably be up online probably by tomorrow, and you can hear it again if you want, and it will be available, because that's what we do. EW, in the background, I'm sure you're going to start hitting some buttons.
Have a big surprise. If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day that teddy bears have their pick.